From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Eduardo Galeano is one of Uruguay's leading writers. He lived in exile when his own country was a military dictatorship. On today's Fresh Air, our book critic John Leonard reviews Galeano's new work. Then Galeano joins us for a reading and interview. Don Dixon, the head of the Vernon Savings and Loan, was sentenced earlier this week. Coming up, a talk with James O'Shea, the author of a new book about Dixon, his bank, and the SNL debacle. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Joni Mitchell's return to her folk-pop roots in her new album, Night Ride Home. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Iran's official news agency said today that there are now about 1 million Kurdish refugees trying to cross into Iran. The Kurds are said to be crowded along a stretch of Iran's mountainous northern border. The news agency said as many as 40 refugees have died from cold and exposure along the road from the northern Iraqi city of Erbil. Iran says that about 1.5 million people are headed toward the border in an effort to escape from Iraqi government forces. Some refugees reported that there was still scattered fighting by Kurdish rebels in the mountains. The United Nations Security Council is taking up the issue of aid for Kurdish refugees and a possible resolution demanding that Saddam Hussein end repression against minority populations. As Linda Fasulo reports from the UN, the drive to help the refugees is being led by Turkey and France.
With 14 million Kurds living in Turkey, Ankara is distressed at the new flood of refugees. Together with France, it is expected to propose a UN resolution that would call for an immediate end to Iraq's repression. It would also ask for urgent humanitarian aid for the refugees, many of them women and children. Although the call for aid is expected to gain wide support in the Council, many countries, including the U.S., have problems with any action that would interfere with Iraq's internal affairs. The Soviet Union and China have already indicated they would veto such a measure. Consultations are expected to continue later this week. For National Public Radio, I'm Linda Fasulo at the UN.
South Africa's Nobel Peace Prize winner, Archbishop Desmond Tutu, has hinted that it may be time to relax international economic sanctions against his country. NPR's John Madison reports from Johannesburg.
Archbishop Tutu told an interviewer that there's now cause for church leaders to look at when they should take the initiative to determine a time that sanctions should be lifted. But when his office was asked if that meant he wants sanctions to go now, a spokesman for the Archbishop was more guarded. The spokesman said Tutu is not saying so yet, because he's saying that it's crucial that there be prior consultation with the oppressed and their leaders. This clarification by his spokesman keeps the Archbishop in line with the official position of the anti-apartheid movement. But his initial statement is consistent with signs that several churches are now reconsidering their automatic support for the policies of opposition politicians like Nelson Mandela. I'm John Madison in Johannesburg.
Stock prices came to a mixed close today on Wall Street after a last-minute attempt at a rally fell apart. Analysts said investors were discouraged by reports of continued weakness in the economy and lower corporate earnings reports. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 2 points to close at 2,924.5. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-2 in heavy trading of 200 million shares. This is NPR News. A federal attorney argued today that the Virginia Military Institute is violating the Constitution by refusing to admit women. VMI's males-only policy is the focus of a sex discrimination case now being tried in Roanoke, Virginia. The Justice Department's John Moore said today that VMI's admissions policy is outdated now that women have proven themselves at federal military academies and in the Persian Gulf War. VMI's attorney said that admitting women would destroy the college's egalitarian and Spartan education system. VMI and the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina, are the only two remaining state-supported military colleges that refuse to accept women. Hundreds of child care workers walked off the job in Seattle today to protest their low wages. Ann Martin of member station KPLU reports.
Despite pouring rain, many of the child care workers along with parents and children marched and sang through downtown Seattle. to remind businesses how critical they are to the city's economic health. Marcy Whitebook, head of the Child Care Employee Project in California, says this is the first time in the United States child care workers have actually closed down a large number of centers to get the attention of parents and businesses concerning their plight.
Basically, child care providers are subsidizing the child care system, and they've got to start saying, no, we won't do that anymore. We're going to close our centers to let you know that something has to be done about it.
About 50 centers joined in today's closure. For National Public Radio, I'm Ann Martin in Seattle.
Police in Sacramento, California say that four gunmen are holding about 30 people hostage in an electronics store after a failed robbery attempt. Authorities said there were no immediate reports of injuries despite a burst of gunfire that was heard in the building. The gunmen released three hostages, a woman and two children. A Thai interpreter was brought in to help with negotiations with the men who apparently don't speak English. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Like many Latin American writers whose countries have become military dictatorships, Eduardo Galeano has spent part of his life in exile. Galeano was one of Uruguay's leading leftist journalists when he fled his country in 1973. He lived first in Argentina, then Spain. In exile, he turned from journalism to literature and wrote the trilogy that he's now internationally known for. It's called Memory of Fire. Since 1985, he's been back in Uruguay. The publication of his new work, The Book of Embraces, has brought him to the States for a visit. We'll meet Galeano in a moment, but first our book critic John Leonard has a review of The Book of Embraces.
If you've never read Eduardo Galeano, I'm hard put to describe exactly who he is and what he does. He's a journalist, but he's always skipping towns like Montevideo or Buenos Aires before the dictatorships get him. He's a Marxist, but it's a Marxism that partakes as much of Groucho as of Karl. He has proposed something called a magical Marxism, one half reason, one half passion, and a third half mystery. He's an historian, but his brilliant trilogy on the Americas, Memory of Fire, is all anecdotal, an impressionist Ferris wheel of vignettes. Imagine an account of the 20th century including Superman and the Bay of Pigs, or Pancho Villa reading the Arabian Nights, or General Trujillo with an ivory fan reviewing the troops at West Point, while Carmen Miranda dances for the King of Belgium. The Book of Embraces is a lot more personal than Memory of Fire. We hear about Galeano's wife, his baldness, and his heart attack. But it's also political, and literary, and anthropological, too. And most of its vignettes are illustrated with Galeano's own pen and ink drawings, as if he were Donald Barthelme or Günter Grass. So what have we? A postmodern mosaic of human resilience in Latin America. Footnotes and eavesdroppings and gossip about Pablo Neruda, Julio Cortazar, and Garcia Marquez. Tiny little texts on art, laughter, friendship, courage, muscle, wind, theology, silence, Indians, a snowy beach in Catalonia, and the culture of terror. Galeano also collects graffiti. On a wall in Bogota, he sees, "Proletarians of all lands unite." Underneath, in another hand, is scrawled, "Final notice." On a wall in Montevideo, there's this, "Assist the police, torture yourself." But he's just as quotable himself. "We are all mortal until the first kiss and the second glass of wine." Or, "Where do people earn the per capita income? More than one starving soul would like to know." And, in the final analysis, it doesn't bother anyone very much that politics be democratic, so long as the economy is not. A sugarcane cutter in Cuba wants to know whether Marxism forbids eating glass. A fisherman in the Dominican Republic is shown a rowing machine and told that it's for exercise. Exercise, he wonders. What's that? A man of the Chilean vineyards, on his deathbed, says, "The grape is made of wine." And Galeano wonders, "Perhaps we were the words that tell us who we are." In Peru, he draws a pig on a little boy's hand. Suddenly, quote, "I was surrounded by a throng of little boys demanding that I draw animals on their little hands, cracked by dirt and cold, their skin of burnt leather. One wanted a condor and one a snake. Others preferred little parrots and owls, and some asked for a ghost or a dragon. Then a little waif who barely cleared a yard off the ground showed me a watch drawn in black ink on his wrist. An uncle of mine who lives in Lima sent it to me," he said. "Does it keep good time?" I asked him. "It's a bit slow," he admitted. That's what the Book of Embraces is all about, besides mirror makers who make mirrors they can walk into and get lost in, and mansions where witches die of boredom, and hotels open only to ghosts, this lovely book is about the hands of children and the words that tell us who we are, the first kiss and the second glass of wine, the per capita income of heroism and solidarity for the human race.
John Leonard is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. Eduardo Galeano just visited our studio for an interview. I asked him first to read a passage from his new book, a passage about friends who were imprisoned while he was in exile. This piece is titled Celebration of the Human Voice.
Their hands were tied or handcuffed, yet their fingers danced, flew, drew words. The prisoners were hooded, but leaning back, they could see a bit, just a bit, down below. Although it was forbidden to speak, they spoke with their hands. Pino Ungerfeld taught me the finger alphabet, which he had learned in prison without a teacher. Some of us had bad handwriting, he told me. Others were masters of calligraphy. The Uruguayan dictatorship wanted everyone to stand alone, everyone to be no one. In prisons and barracks and throughout the country, communication was a crime. Some prisoners spent more than 10 years buried in solitary cells the size of coffins, hearing nothing but clanging bars or footsteps in the corridors. Fernández Huidobro and Mauricio Rosenkopf, thus condemned, survived because they could talk to each other by tapping on the wall. In that way, they told of dreams and memories, fallings out and out of love. They discussed, embraced, fought. They shared beliefs and beauties, doubts and guilts, and those questions that have no answer. When it is genuine, when it is born of the need to speak, no one can stop the human voice. When denied the mouth, it speaks with the hands or the eyes or the pores or anything at all, because every single one of us has something to say to the others, something that deserves to be celebrated or forgiven by others.
Eduardo Galeano, when did you feel that it was safe for you to return to Uruguay?
I went back to my country at the beginning of 1985.
Was that after the dictatorship had fallen?
Yes, it was at the end. It was finishing.
You had many friends who stayed in Uruguay. Were many of those friends in prison or tortured?
Yes.
During the years that you were in exile?
Yes, a lot of them. A lot of them.
How did they seem changed by the experience? Were they very different when you met them later?
They were different, and I was different also, because time passed by and you change if you're really alive. You know? So at the beginning you leave, I mean, you're coming back and you really never went away. But afterwards you realize that the country changed, and you also changed. And it took some time for me to accept it. And I am still thinking that and feeling that the Uruguay is a country I choose to live.
You had friends who were imprisoned and who were tortured. You probably also had friends, though, who tried to suppress their own opposition to the dictatorship so that they and their family could live safely. And I wonder how you think they were changed by suppressing that opposition.
They were in exile also, no? The inside exile, the exile inside the frontiers. It was a structure of fear. Fear is really something that once you are trained to eat it each day, you know, fear at breakfast and fear at lunch and fear at dinner. Later, it's quite difficult to get rid of it. People who were living in Uruguay in that period were obliged to silence and obliged to lie. You should lie to survive. And later it's, there are some mutilations, you say, mutilations of the soul that are not registered in any statistical, information. But on these secret wounds are terrible, no? In a country who have suffered a long military dictatorship.
How democratic is Uruguay now?
Well, politically it's democratic. I mean, there are a lot of political parties and we have freedom of expression and so on. The problem is that Uruguay, as almost all Latin American countries, have undemocratic or anti-democratic economic and social structures. So poverty increased a lot in these last 20 or 25 years, and the country is unable to give a decent job to young people, and so we have a structure who is refusing young people the right to live in their own country, and this is quite undemocratic, no?
What do you mean it's refusing people the right to live in their own country?
They are expelled by economic conditions. I mean, they cannot get a job, a decent job inside Uruguay, so they are obliged to go outside. And some of them, if they can, they come here in the States or elsewhere, Australia, Hawaii, Brazil. I don't know, everywhere you find Uruguayan people, we are like gypsies. And expelled by this economic and social structure, which I think is deeply anti-democratic, no? Because if you are a prisoner of necessity, then you are not a free person.
My guest is the Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, who's best known for his trilogy Memory of Fire, which is, well, like a poetic history of the Americas. His new book is called The Book of Embraces. And we'll talk some more after we take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is the Uruguayan writer Eduardo Galeano, who's now visiting the United States on the occasion of the publication of his new book, The Book of Embraces. There was a petition in Uruguay a few years ago to punish the people of the dictatorship, to punish the torturers.
Yes.
And basically the government ruled out so many of the signatures for very trivial reasons. That the petition was basically thrown out. So, when in Uruguay now are there people who you run into who you know were torturers or executioners, and do you speak with them? How do you handle?
No, I don't know personally any executioner or any torturer, but I'm a friend of a lot of people who have been tortured, and they have suffered this experience. And there are scars in the soul, not only in the body, mainly in the soul. But, you know, people is in any way trying to live. And I believe that fear is not a good counselor. Mm-hmm. Counselor. Fear of doing induces you to paralysis. The fear of thinking makes you a stupid person, and when you feel fear of remembering, you are perhaps doomed to repeat history instead of making it.
You have a story in your new book, The Book of Embraces.
Yes.
And I imagine this is about a friend of yours. This is someone who was tortured while he was in prison, and his torturer would always, after administering the torture, the torturer would complain about his nagging wife and what a pest his child was. And the person who he tortured was supposed to, what, feel sympathetic toward him because of this? He was lying there with blood all over him?
Yes, it happens like this. It's incredible. But they are really functionaries. I mean, I wouldn't say that the torturers and inquisitors and executioners of all these terrible military dictatorships we have suffered in Latin America and elsewhere also, that they have a certain greatness of horror, let's say. They don't have any greatness, not even the greatness of horror. They are just bureaucrats of terror, functionaries of this machine of fear. And this is the way it happens. I mean, they do their job 8 hours per day, and afterwards they are good family fathers and with their family life and so on. And this is what I was describing in the book.
Yeah, and I think the point you're trying to make there, too, is that they see themselves as just doing the job.
Just doing the job, yes. Because this is not only true about torturers. It's true about everybody, that in the modern dominant culture, you are obliged to this sort of schizophrenia, so that a lot of people, I think most of people, are obliged to live a contre-coeur, no? Against its own feelings. And you finally accept it, and you finish playing the role as an actor. And it's not only true about torturers.
Have you ever been imprisoned yourself?
Yes, but it was a few days, just 9 or 10 days. I was isolated in a cell and menaced of being tortured, but they didn't torture me. I was a privileged prisoner.
Because you were well known?
Yes, I suppose that I was more or less protected by fame, a certain fame. And this may be unjust, but that's the way it is.
When was this?
Oh, a lot of years ago. It was, I don't remember now, 1973, I think, 73.
Now, that was the year that you left Uruguay?
Yes, afterwards I left, because I don't want to live in prison. I mean, after they released me, I went away. And afterwards I lived in Argentina, where I found and directed a cultural magazine called Crisis. It was a very successful magazine. And later, times got worse there and worse, and I was obliged to leave Argentina too, and I went to Spain, because I don't want to be a prisoner, but I don't want to be a dead man also. It's, I prefer to be alive. It's much better than being a heroic corpse.
You once wrote, "I am a man from the South, and Latin American history teaches us to mistrust words."
Yes.
Why?
Well, they are used, bad used, ill used. They are manipulated, I mean. Words and images by the media and by the educational system and so on. In Uruguay, for instance, Liberty is the name of a prison. Can you imagine? And if you, I don't know, get inside the message you're receiving each day from the media, you are always discovering this contradiction between words and sense. And I think the adventure of writing have a sense if you can help to recover the lost sense of words. I mean, to give them back their lost sense. And this is true, I think, for almost all the words that are used each day, like love or democracy or freedom or everything.
If you're just joining us, my guest is writer Eduardo Galeano, who's visiting the United States from Uruguay on the occasion of the publication of his new book, The Book of Embraces. Do you think of yourself now as a Marxist or a socialist?
I have been strongly influenced by two sources. The first one was the Catholic Church. I was very, very Catholic when I was a child. And later I was a student, a very good student of Marxism. And I think I have been marked by both influences. So I feel free. I mean, I wouldn't consider myself nothing, nor a Christian or a Marxist or nothing, no? Because I think it's a way of putting your freedom outside of yourself. I don't like any sort of determinism. I think I'm a free man. But anyway, from all that years, I learned that that Christianism cannot be reduced to the Holy Inquisition, and that socialism cannot be reduced to Stalinism.
When you returned to Uruguay, was there any resentment toward the exiles?
Yes.
From the people who stayed?
Yes, certainly. There are. But it's universal. It's not an Uruguayan virtue. The envy. Envy is universal. It's humankind.
So how would it be expressed to you?
I don't know. I don't care about it. I mean, it's at the beginning, there were a lot of problems between the exiled people and the people who were there. No? Some people felt that they were heroes of patriotism because they stood in the country in all the years of terror and fear, the dirty, dirty years. And other people felt that they were heroes of freedom because they were in exile in all these dirty, terrible years. And I think that it's really a misunderstanding, because it doesn't depend on the place you are. It's not a geographical question, being free or being a real patriot. I mean, loving your country doesn't depend on where you live.
I'd like to ask you something, and I know the answer might seem obvious, but it might not be obvious at all. It might be really different than what any of us would expect. When it was safe to go back to Uruguay, why did you want to go back? You didn't have to go back.
No, I didn't. I choose Uruguay because I like my country and I like my people. But it's something you can't explain. I mean, you know, if I'm not stupid enough to think that I can explain love or and I have a love relationship with my own country, which implies that it's a very complicated relationship sometimes with quarrels and disputes and hates and so on, like any real love relation, which is also a hate relationship and so on, not only loving each other in heaven. We are on the earth, and therefore everything is so contradictory and complicated. But anyway, I think it's the sort of marvel and horror I prefer.
Do you have contradictory emotions about the United States?
And about myself and about everything, because I'm alive, and there's a lot of contradictions inside. And fortunately enough, because otherwise it would be impossible.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I hope you have a good stay while you're visiting the States. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
My guest has been Eduardo Galeano, who is from Uruguay, is now visiting the United States, and his new book is called The Book of Embraces. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Earlier this week, Don Dixon, head of the Vernon Savings and Loan, was sentenced for defrauding regulators and illegally spending the money of his depositors. For journalist James O'Shea, Dixon's story is a case study in what created the SNL debacle. O'Shea's new book is about Don Dixon and the Vernon Savings and Loan. Coming up, a talk with O'Shea about some very creative financing. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Night Ride Home, the new album by Joni Mitchell. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In spite of stepped-up security measures at Turkey's border with Iraq, officials say about 100,000 Kurdish refugees have crossed over. The president of Turkey says about 100,000 Iraqi Kurdish refugees are now in his country. NPR's John Harkinberry is in the Turkish city of Gaitman on the Iraqi border, and he says the closed border is not stopping the rush of Kurdish refugees.
Turgut Özal, the Turkish president, said that a large number of people have been allowed to cross the Iraqi frontier and remain in the no man's land between the two checkpoints. We don't know exactly how many have actually been allowed in, but it is clear that part of that statement is responding to the fact that people are just streaming in. They're coming across mountainous, rugged terrain that is not surveyed and is impossible to completely control. And so many of the people who are in this no man's land are there by their own efforts, and the Turkish government is sort of acknowledging that they're there. But I wouldn't necessarily call it a welcoming gesture on the part of the Turks at this point.
NPR's John Hockenberry on the Turkish-Iraqi border. The State Department says Iraqi government troops now control all the major cities and towns in the country. Officials say that there is still scattered fighting in both the northern and southern parts of Iraq, but Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein now controls all the major areas. Pennsylvania Senator John Hines and six others were killed today when his airplane and a helicopter collided in midair. The crash occurred over a school outside of Philadelphia, and police said that two children on the ground were killed. The FAA says there were three people in the plane, two on board the helicopter, and that there were no survivors. Hines was on his way to Philadelphia, where he was to hold a special committee on aging hearing tomorrow morning. In Sacramento, California, four armed men are holding about 30 people hostage inside a store. Beth Duncan has more on the story.
The hostages were taken following an apparent robbery attempt at the store early this afternoon. The sheriff's department says shots have been fired, but there is no word on possible victims. Five workers escaped from the warehouse in the back of the store. They said they were warned by a saleswoman. And a short time ago, three of the hostages, a woman and two small children, were released after sheriff's deputies delivered bulletproof vests to the armed men inside. Negotiations with the men have been made difficult due to a language barrier. The men are of Southeast Asian descent. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Duncan in Sacramento.
Police in Northern Ireland say a 1,000-pound bomb exploded outside a courthouse today, causing widespread damage and minor injuries. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved down over 2 points to close at 2,924.50. This is NPR News. In Los Angeles, Police Chief Daryl Gates has been placed on a paid leave of absence while investigations are made into the videotape beating of a motorist by a group of police officers. The move was taken by the Civilian Police Commission, which gave no reason for the forced 60-day leave. Gates says he will fight the order. The commission says that it will name an interim chief of police. Meanwhile, two panels, one appointed by the mayor and the other by Gates, will merge their efforts to investigate the L.A. Police Department. The Soviet Parliament has given preliminary approval to a plan granting wide-ranging new powers to Russian Federation President Boris Yeltsin. He requested the powers this morning, saying that they were needed to overcome a political stalemate in the Republic. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The plan would authorize Yeltsin to issue decrees with the force of law, though Russia's legislature would hold a final veto power over his actions. The lopsided vote in favor of expanding Yeltsin's authority marked a breakthrough at the chaotic session of the Russian parliament, where for 8 days hardline communists have battled pro-Yeltsin forces on every issue. The parliamentary session was called by Yeltsin's foes, who had hoped to remove him from his leadership position. Instead, they may have given him an opportunity to strengthen his authority as he continues his battle to increase Russia's autonomy from the controls of the central government, led by Yeltsin's arch-rival, Mikhail Gorbachev. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
According to the Red Cross, more than 15,000 Iraqi war refugees now being cared for by the U.S. military will be returned to Iraqi control when U.S. forces leave. According to military officials, about 600 wounded civilians have been treated every day since March 25th. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. One of the leading players in the savings and loan debacle was sentenced earlier this week. Don Dixon, the head of the Vernon SNL in Texas, was convicted of defrauding regulators and illegally spending depositors' money. He used some of that money to buy a California beach house and to pay for women to accompany Vernon officials and guests on trips and to parties. James O'Shea says Dixon used Vernon as his personal piggy bank. O'Shea is the author of a book about how Dixon sunk the Vernon SNL. It's called The Daisy Chain. That's a term used to describe a you-scratch-my-back-I'll-scratch-yours scheme that Dixon used to boost the earnings and net worth of the SNL. Dixon faced a maximum of 120 years. He was sentenced to only 5, and he's eligible for parole in December of 92. He faced a maximum fine of $5.6 million. The judge ordered him to pay $600,000. O'Shea thinks Dixon got off easy.
I think the sentence really represents a setback to the Justice Department's strategy of prosecuting savings and loan crimes, not only in Vernon but elsewhere. They had developed a theory, I think, that if the actual looting of a savings and loan often involves many complex transactions. And the idea of they had been unsuccessful in some earlier prosecutions of taking these cases before a jury because the jury would be confused by the complexity of the transactions, and they would end up with mistrials and hung juries. So they began going on the simpler types of crimes. Dixon was accused of hiring prostitutes for board members and diverting the proceeds of Vernon's savings to make monthly payments on a beach house in Solana Beach, California, which was used as sort of a weekend hideaway. So I think, you know, they really concentrated on the simple charges. It's pretty easy to get a jury. You put a witness up there. You say, did you hire a prostitute? He says, yes. And the witness is, then you say, who asked you to hire that prostitute? He says, Don Dixon. It's a pretty simple case for a jury to understand. And they convicted him on that. And for that crime, he was given 5 years, and facing a total of 120. I don't think a judge can justify sending him to jail of 120 years for hiring a prostitute. And he was not really even tried on the charges of looting a savings and loan. There is a pending civil case in which he is charged of that.
What does it say to you that some of the real deals that were responsible for sinking the SNL, he isn't being charged for because they're just too complicated to explain to a jury?
Well, I think it's a pretty sad commentary on the way we are trying these people. I mean, it's the old thing. If you go into a bank and rob it with a gun, you'll get 20 years. But if you take a pencil and paper and you get a white collar crime going, it's much harder to convict.
Let's see if you can explain in a way we can understand some of the more complicated financial goings-on at the Vernon SNL in Texas. Now Don Dixon was a real estate developer, and that's what the SNL specialized in after he took it over. What are some of the innovative ways he came up with, some of the creative ways he came up with for making profits on shaky real estate deals?
Well, basically what Dixon did is he got a hold of the savings and loan and began offering higher interest rates to lure into the SNL large deposits from pension funds and well-heeled investors around the country. And as this money sort of poured into Vernon's savings, he would invest it in real estate projects that were designed to generate profits for the savings and loan and thereby generate dividends and salaries and bonuses for Don Dixon and his cohorts. Innovative, I don't know if you would say this, Don Dixon was the only one who was an innovator in this sphere down in Texas, but what he would do, they would, for instance, engage in land flips where they would just sell the land back and forth in sort of paper transactions. Let's say you start off and you have a parcel of land and you sell it to developer A for $1 million, and then he turns around and sells it back to someone for $2 million, and it goes back and forth until you get the price up to about $10 million. And keep in mind, this is just a paper transaction, and then the savings and loan makes a loan off of the $10 million transaction, and all along this little chain of sales, people earn fees and earn profits and off of this thing. And then when they get done, the savings and loan lends the chosen developer the $10 million or $12 or $13 million that's needed to fund the project. And so you have basically taxpayer-backed deposits being given to someone to buy a piece of land. And then if they walk away from it, the taxpayer is the one who's stuck with it. Don Dixon also...
Wait, let me get back to this one. How do you get the land to flip over so many times? How do you get people to buy and sell and buy and sell?
Well, it's like all that? Sort of, I mean, it's all understood. We're going to do this. This is not a legitimate business transaction. This is all arranged ahead of time. And the way you get these people to go along with it is they make money every time it's sold. If I sell you a piece of land for $1 million and you turn around and sell it to somebody else for $2 million right away, you just made $1 million. I mean, that's an exaggerated case. You can get a commission. You can get a sales commission of $200,000 for being in on the sale. You can get a fee, a finder's fee. All of these techniques were employed in these kinds of sophisticated land sales that went on down there that were financed by these savings and loans, all designed to benefit this select group of real estate developers. They used to call them the Vernon family of borrowers. Quite a family.
Don Dixon was a real estate developer. When he took over the SNL, did he use any of the money to finance his own deals?
Oh, sure.
Is that legal?
Well, under the way the Garn St. Germain bill evolved, yes. I mean, in other words, what happened is you're a real estate developer. I'm Don Dixon. I buy this savings and loan. Prior to the laws that were passed, you could not take money from those federally insured deposits and use them in your own deals. It was prohibited by the regulations. Those regulations were repealed. And what you had is that he would set up a development subsidiary, the Don R. Dixon Development Subsidiary. In this case, it would be Vernon Savings Real Estate Investments, Inc. Then Vernon Savings would lend money to Vernon Savings Real Estate Investment, Inc., and it would be invested in a deal in which Dixon and some of his fellow partners were partners. And so they would then use that money to develop their own deals. And that was all permitted under the way the Congress redrew the laws.
Did the Vernon SNL's real estate deals have a lasting effect on real estate value in Texas?
Well, sure. When you had all of these people able to jump into the real estate market and you had an ample source of money flowing into the state, and you had oil prices increasing, one regulator described it to me as sort of a feeding frenzy. These people came in and they began bidding for this land and they drove up the price of the land. There was already an inflationary psychology from oil prices increasing. So as they got in and they began bidding up the price of the land prices rose generally. And so the real estate prices just sort of followed them up. And then when the market kind of turned on them and there was a downward pressure, they were able to keep up the price of land for a while because they would engage in these daisy chain transactions. You know, all of a sudden the land didn't appear to be as worth as much. It wasn't generating sufficient income to pay the loan. So they'd refinance it. And so, they drove up real estate prices. And then by overbuilding, they accelerated the decline once the bubble burst because there was so much of it out there that had been overbuilt, and so much of these loans had gone into real estate developments that probably weren't economical. They were just created to generate fees for these guys.
My guest is James O'Shea, author of a new book on Don Dixon and the Vernon SNL called The Daisy Chain. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist James O'Shea is my guest. Dunzixson had his ways of manipulating people who he did business with. You say that if you got a loan from the Vernon SNL, well, you were expected to buy memberships in Don Dixon's private club. And then if you didn't play ball, what would happen?
Well, one guy described this to me, and I think he said no one really held a gun to your head. But you would come into Vernon's savings offices, and you'd say, I need a loan. And I'm a real estate developer, and I'm pressed. I need the loan because if I don't get a loan, someone's going to default and take my project over. And if they take my project over, there's my source of income gone. So you come in and say, I need a $10 million loan. And they say, well, what do you need that for? Well, I need $7 million to pay off savings loan over here. I need $7 million to pay off my loan, and I need $3 million to keep me afloat for a while until the economy revives. And they say, oh, sure, we'll give you the $10 million loan. That's a great deal. And they say, by the way, you know, we've got something called the Moonlight Beach Club, and we'd like you to join the Moonlight Beach Club. It's a beach club out in Solana Beach, California. It's got some condominiums. You get the free use of a condo. You get the free use of a BMW while you're there 1 week a year. A membership will cost you about anywhere from $77,500 to $135,000. Now you don't have to worry about coming up with any cash because we, you know, Vernon Saves will lend you the membership fee. And so you put down, say, 10%, and so that's $7,000 to $13,000, and you join the club, you know, and you know, it wasn't like if you don't join the club, you're not going to get your loan. But you know, the message was pretty clear. Most people understood it was a cost of doing business. And after all, what's $7,000 to $10,000 or $13,000 when you're asking for a $10 million loan? I mean, it's peanuts. So you say, okay, I'll join the club. And so pretty soon you're a member of the Moonlight Beach Club. And the Moonlight Beach Club, the members, was owned partially by Don Dixon and Woody Lemons. And they were developing this thing, and they then would benefit from the fees coming in, the management fees on the beach club. When the property was sold, they made a profit. They got part of the land on themselves. So it was one of those little back-scratching arrangements.
Do you think it's been a real lucky break for the SNL guys that they've been eclipsed by the war in the Gulf and the war's aftermath?
Oh, sure. I mean, you were beginning to see a lot of attention focus on the savings loan, particularly the political elements of it. I think it's probably better for the politicians than it is for the people who were involved in the savings and loan, you know, running the savings and loans. We have here a situation where you know, you always hear in Washington, and I spent almost 13 years of my life as a reporter in Washington, and you hear in Washington now, well, you know, there's enough blame to go around. Let's not cast blame. Let's resolve the problem. Well, that's very nice to say, but by not focusing on what went wrong, I think we're repeating the same mistakes we made in the banking crisis. But I think the people who really got away with it were the politicians, because there were once people began understanding what was going wrong back in the mid-1980s, people were talking about it. People were issuing warnings. So Ed Gray, the chief regulator, many others were saying, we've got a disaster coming, and they didn't deal with it. They could have dealt with this in 1985 at probably a cost of $10 to $15 billion, all of which could have been absorbed by the savings and loan industry. Instead, Congress and the White House and the Reagan administration stuck their head in the sand, and they allowed it to continue going on. And the longer it went on, the more expensive it got. So by the time people began figuring out that there was a lot of culpability and began scrutinizing what went on, when other journalists began looking at it, just at the height, as they were really starting to bear in, the war comes along and eclipses it and blows it off of page one. There's pressure. There's no longer the public pressure to give these people stiff sentences, and there's no longer you don't see the outrage that you were seeing that was building. I think it's there. People are still angry about it, but I think the war sort of eclipsed it and took the pressure off of people, and it'll have to rebuild again. And you may see it revive when you begin seeing the same problems surfacing in the banking industry.
James O'Shea, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
That's quite all right.
James O'Shea is the author of The Daisy Chain. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Noah, what do you have on Iraqis fleeing their country?
We heard today from NPR's John Hockenberry reporting from a village along the Turkish border with Iraq. He says it's a very desperate situation there. Very few of the refugees from northern Iraq are getting through into Turkey. Many thousands more are waiting in the mountains in the snow and also in a cold rain. Also tonight, Daryl Gates, the police chief of Los Angeles, is going on administrative leave during the investigation into charges of police brutality in Los Angeles. Our family series continues with Verda Mae Grosvenor going to South Carolina to report about teenage families, talking with several young couples there.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Our rock critic Ken Tucker has often pointed out the influence of Joni Mitchell on many other singer-songwriters, her open tunings, harmonies, wordplay, and poetry. Now Mitchell is back with her own new album. Ken says it's her most accessible in more than a decade.
Once in a while, in a big blue moon, there comes a night like this, like some surrealist invented this 4th of July. Night at home. Pool of girls and caterpillar tractors in the sand. The ukulele man. The fireworks this 4th of July. Night at home.
The new Joni Mitchell album is entitled Night Ride Home, but she may as well have called it Okay, I Give Up. After so many years spent denying her talent as a pop writer and persistently experimenting with open-ended jazz structures, Mitchell has relented somewhat. She knows darn well that we, her longtime fans, have been waiting for her to return to the edgy, revelatory pop-folk style that produced great albums like Blue, For the Roses, and Court and Spark in the early 70s. At the same time, we're too mannerly to actually come out and tell an artist of Mitchell's hothouse sensibility that she really ought to be working in a style that's now 20 years old. So we've been patient, and we've waited, and now the wait has paid off.
Cherokee Louise is hiding in this tunnel in the Broadway Bridge. We're crawling on our knees. We got flashlights and batteries. We got cold cuts from the fridge. Last year, about this time, we used to climb up in the branches just to sway there in some breeze.
Even when Mitchell sets up a cool jazz riff on that song, Cherokee Louise, complete with soprano saxophone tooting from Wayne Shorter, she gives herself a sweet, precise melody to sing within it. For the past two decades, Mitchell has been interested primarily in lengthening and fragmenting her tunes, forcing them to submit to the whims of improvisation. On Night Ride Home, she's interested in tightening up her music, in pinning down choruses and verbal images. The result is a crisp, disciplined album that nonetheless conveys warmth and intimacy. On no song is this more beguiling than on Come In From the Cold.
Back in 1957, we had to dance a foot apart. And they hawked us from the sidelines, holding their rulers without a heart. And so with just a touch of our fingers, oh, we could make our circuit be explode. All we ever wanted was just to come in from the cold.
Come In From the Cold is, at 7.5 minutes, the longest song on Night Ride Home. It's also the album's best. For all the music's confident surge, it's a song about doubt. On the most superficial level, it's Mitchell's admission that she's come in from the cold, from the chilly reception that albums like Don Juan's Reckless Daughter and Mingus received, from being frozen out as a commercial pop artist. But on another, deeper level, it's a song about despair, of giving in to feelings of helplessness. Near the end of the song, she even comes close to repudiating her most experimental work.
When I thought life had some meaning, then I thought I had some choice. And I made some valued judgments in a self-important voice. But then absurdity came over me, and I longed to lose control. All I had wanted was just to come in.
Night Ride Home isn't a great album. There are a few stiff melodies, and there's an attempt to set William Butler Yeats to music that's just awkward and pretentious. But like its immediate predecessors, Chalkmark in a Rainstorm and especially Dog Eat Dog, Night Ride Home describes a Joni Mitchell who's moving back into the mainstream of popular music, where she belongs.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for Entertainment Weekly.
Botticelli style, instead of Venus on a clown, I paint this flower child. You are the air my flowers breathe, the corals and the ladies turn around. On the first day of spring, I'm looking at the only joy. Steps are crowded.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audie Voblaitis, Richard Parker, and Ron Barron. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we analyze the U.S. policy of not interfering in Iraq's civil war. My guest will be New York Times reporter Patrick Tyler. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.